And he's kind of going, well, we can see dolphins in Queensland. Do you know what I mean? We have more dolphins than we know what to do with. Why would we waste our time and money? And they're both kind of being, they can't negotiate this.
Yeah.
It's part of one of the things that leads to the eventual demise of the relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's also the thing that gives the short story, it's like narrative propulsion. So like as in the tension that's kind of essential and the dissolution between these two characters is what creates the situation for the story itself.
Yeah, look, if I could just come in on that. There's this thing that if you're being somewhat experimental, you never use plot.
Yeah.
No way, this is a false binary.
Yeah.
If ever there was one. There is nothing wrong with using kind of standard Aristotelian forward movement plot devices.
Yeah.
There seems to be this automatic, as soon as you're not using story device or plot devices in particular, you're being experimental. Why can't you have them?
Yeah.
So I'm getting ranty here, aren't I?
Definitely. I also think this is interesting because it's like you're presented with a situation. So like the form allows a type of situationalism because it's like it has to be immediate, like, you know, so there's a certain urgency, but you don't necessarily notice this on a sentence to sentence level with Anthony's story because it's like you see this breakdown in this relationship and you know it's coming, but it's precise calibrations is what you're interested in.
Yeah. Like forward movement and anticipation. Anticipation, suspense, you can do these in all sorts of ways, and they don't have to be framed around highly melodramatic plot structures. They can these techniques can be used in whatever kind of, well, I actually don't use the term story, I think of a line of action.
Okay.
Because that decouples you from plot. I mean, plot's such a big word. It's sort of embedded in that Forsterian notion of, you know, what is it, the king died, the queen died of grief. I mean, I won't.
Yeah.
But there has to be causation and strict causation in plot. I quite like this idea of a line of action that's forward moving.
Yeah.
And you can have all the obligatory flashbacks and all that, but I like that in a story.
I mean, I also think in that way, what helps you move this line of action along is characters that are relatable. So like you could, well, I felt they were relatable to me, partly because I have like done this grand tour, partly because I have had relationships dissolve in my 20s, partly because there's moments that you recognise either in the ham sandwich store or the gallery or the kind of relationship you have with the hotel manager who's around your same age. Can you talk a little bit about though the accumulation of those experiences and what that means for like setting an idea of character or like how that turns into a character for you? So what I'm asking about is the relationship between the line of action and how characters move along that line of action.
Yeah, look, I don't have any problem with there has to be some kind of identification effect between the reader and the kind of main characters, or identification effect probably isn't the best term, or at least their ability to project themselves into the character's position, so they live through the experiential dimension of the narrative. Because you get onto all that Brechtian stuff of, you know, the identification effect to create an alienation effect. And these are standard things apparently you should be doing but they've become cliches of experimentation. Okay, so I want relatability is probably not quite I'm after, but I do want the ability of the reader to project themselves via the kind of the character and go through the journey of the story. It's such a powerful effect. And if you can do it, they don't have to like the character particularly. It's more this idea of projecting themselves in. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm more interested in.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that helps you project yourself into that is because you do have these cultural touchstones that look back at you. So, you know, like Anthony yesterday was saying that he started out at art school. And so, like, art has remained a kind of, like, element that goes through the rest of his body of work. And in this story, there's, like, El Greco, Mona Lisa, Duchamp, and the kind of art looks back at you. So you kind of have this resonance that allows you to travel through it. Can you just talk a little bit about art and this kind of intertextuality?
Yeah, sure. Okay, so my characters are in Paris, finally. And the female character, Carol's quite playful. And she says, let's play a game with Paris. I'll pick the first destination, I'm not going to tell you. We'll go there in the morning, and you'll pick a second destination in the afternoon, you're going to tell me, and we'll go there. So that's kind of, it's sort of based on something I've heard, actually. I never did it, I just heard this backpack a couple, you know, obviously I went through an experience like that, so I've sort of stolen that and infected it. But the game becomes a way of, you know what I mean, like, imagine just plotting that in a standard way. First they went to, you know, to see Duchamp's fountain, then they went to see, you know, whatever, boring. So I'm looking for devices that do a few things: reveal character through action, collapse setting. So once again, getting it onto the plane, like, so Paris is a setting, but not using it as a backdrop, but incorporating it into the field of action, if you see what I'm getting at. So they're playing a game with the city. So there's that kind of formalist level of just trying to enliven a narrative. Sorry, Dave, you'll live by being clever. But, you know, it's just trying to do things differently and interestingly. Yeah. But also then there's the kind of meta-discourse on aesthetics of, well, Duchamp. I mean, I'm kind of saying something sneaky there. And I no longer really engage with visual arts. I don't even particularly like Marcel Duchamp's work in a lot of ways. But I kind of think he's arguably the most important artist that ever lived. Because he just made us... You know, the perception of a chair could become an artwork.
Yeah.
Art and aesthetics changed forever. There's a before and after Duchamp, in my view. And I get frustrated that in kind of literary culture, if you come from an art school culture and you know something of visual aesthetics, it frustrates me that you get in philosophy, you get in other discourses in music, but literature's sort of oddly epistemologically naive.
Yeah.
And it seems to have ignored these types of huge aesthetic transformations. You know? So I'm not coming from a writer who's a journalist or that. You know what I mean? There are various parts of being a writer and they're all okay. I'm coming from a completely different space, from aesthetics, visual arts, philosophy. You know, that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah. I think that's partly interesting what you say, because thinking about Duchamp and thinking about him as a hinge moment means also thinking about the relationship not only to creativity, like individual works of art, but the frame in which they're experienced in. And in that way, the setting, like you say, is brought into the field of action. And that is like Paris of their mind's eye that they project once they go there, but it's also more intimate spaces. So it's like Paris is a city, but it's also the hotel room.
Mm.
It's also the specificity that lives inside Paris. Can you talk about some of those like interior spaces? Because this also goes with like thinking about when you said market forces was like fish and chip shop of childhood,
yeah,
as opposed to something abstract or the relationship between those two things. So can you talk about that kind of specificity of setting?
So I mean, the hotel room, for example, you know, a hotel room couple abroad, it's going to kind of be a younger couple, it's going to be an intimate space. So I'm interested in, or you know, couple at art gallery alone with each other. It's kind of an enclosed kind of entity. It's very sort of close and it's very you know that huge pressure that's put on you if you're in a couple going overseas? It's sort of you and the other person, and the huge compression of a foreign space upon you.
Yeah.
So you get these kind of... Oh, look, I don't know what I ate for breakfast. I'm just in theory mode this morning. Bakhtin's chronotypes. Okay, so this idea of the pendulum swing from the... in War and Peace, from the drawing room to the battlefield. And there's this pendulum swing. And yeah. You can argue that that's the sort of main structural, you know... feature dramatically of something like War and Peace. So, you know, intimate space, the airplane, the hotel room,
yeah,
the Ham Museum where they have a decisive breach, sort of, and they've all got some kind of underlying element of capital.
Yeah.
And then the huge compression of, you know, this huge thing of Europe bearing down upon them.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's interesting what you're saying, but I mean, in that way, I think what you had for breakfast this morning was theory. You probably just ate a bowl of theory.
Yeah.
I quite like that. You know, because it allows me to kind of like enter into that space too.
And gluten-free theory.
Good gluten-free theory. You know, perhaps it's like, it might not be theory light, but it might be full-fat theory.
Low GI theory.
Low GI theory, yeah, the slow burn theory. I think this is partly interesting also because it tells us partly about the intellectual moment of formation,
yep,
which is happening around the time these stories are written. So that's like the kind of first thing we engage with, is like looking back on this kind of Baroque postmodernism. But also in thinking about what the characters themselves are reading and engaging with, because they're living in this world too.
Mm.
And there's this kind of like, it's all on one plane, but it's also, there's like meta levels of commentary here,
mm-hmm,
that's built on a line of action. But it doesn't necessarily, like the reading experience of all these things is like, we're bringing up the sediment here. Because for me, the reading experience was like on a sentence to sentence level, something kind of, you know, something's going on, but there's like, it obeys the logics of pleasure and enjoyment and comedy and those kinds of like, reading effects as well. So can you talk a little bit about how stories are supposed to be read in a kind of experience way? Like, what's the reading in experience or the reading of an experience that relates to reading as an experience?
What I expect the reader, the reader will engage with.
Yeah.
Look, I care a lot about the reader. People won't believe that when they read my work, but when I come decided I was going to go into writing. I mean, I always saw it as you're writing for an audience.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not into this thing, I'm just writing for my own pleasure, and if I'm really going to enjoy that, then someone else will enjoy it too. No, never ever thought that. I'm always trying to exercise this double optic of, I'm writing this, how would a reader experience this?
Yeah.
Now, the problem with that is that readers are highly variable. There'll be this type of reader, that sort of reader, this sort of reader. But I think if you go into writing without a sense of that, you're doing yourself a disservice. And there's something really rich and satisfying about that double optic. It really hones your communication skills. So you're thinking, you know, you're writing something, you're thinking, is this lucid? Is it sort of an exercise in sense-making that has an applicability, you know, outside of myself? Does it have clarity and all that sort of thing? So if you'll see in my writing that I'm not particularly vague. I'm probably over-specific, if anything. So there's kind of that aspect of it. But then I start getting very pragmatic, and I start thinking in terms of audiences and markets.
Yeah.
Because I think you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't think about where in any contemporary publishing field your work might fit in.
Yeah.
So there's that as well. So I'm thinking about all those factors at the same time. But that's kind of very practical. In terms of like what sort of reading experience do I want to offer? Look, you know, this is kind of what material is going to appeal to, you know, people who graduate from arts degrees. There's still 45% of the university population. The university population is getting bigger all the time. This is sounding very big data, isn't it? they're always going to be around. They're always going to be curious, intellectually excited, not a good word, people who want to engage with interesting ideas and have a bit of fun with them.
Yeah, I think in that way there is a lot of fun in these stories. Like, I mean, there's like a lot of humour that's both understated and like in your face. Like, I do think that the Ham Museum is a great place to stage a fight. If only for the kind of hilarity of like lots of hams hanging around you, you know, it's really interesting. You know, like, it's a very good image of like a place to have an argument.
It's this cafe, and the entire ceiling has ham legs hanging from the top of it, and it reeks of cured ham. I'll never forget it. It's still there.
It's a kind of great juxtaposition. Okay. Seeing as we're on this,
on ham.
Seeing as we're on ham, I don't necessarily want to theorize ham, though we could theorize the Hawaiian pizza because it's probably worth theorizing. But I want to zoom out slightly and also ask you about this kind of question of this, like, where the work sits in this reading experience. It's like all these things are happening in a kind of intellectual way too, as well as a typing big data. There's lots of things going on that we can articulate. But also, I wonder if you articulate where these short stories sit in a kind of frame, because you've spoken about this kind of realism-modernism divide elsewhere, you know, and Anthony Ullman in his review of An Experience also cited your work about the realism-modernism divide. So, like, can you talk about realism and modernism either as negotiating forces or antithetical forces in this, but also, like, what might be, in a Marxist way, from Hegelian, I also was their synthesis, if that's something you're
interested in. Yeah, I do. Yeah, look, I write theoretical work as well, obviously, and I wrote an essay a while ago, I can't remember the title of it now, Sense-Making and Now. Okay, cut a long story short. I mean, if you do any kind of standard literary studies for any period of time, there's this great binary of realism and modernism, and it's this foundational binary. Realism is kind of, you know, Stendhal's mirror going down a road where it's kind of a reflection theory that you can represent in words the real. Modernism apparently problematizes this sort of referential relationship, and it kind of goes, no, the mind and human subjectivity creates worlds from kind of, you know, sense impressions. We can never have a reliable correlation between the way our mind reconstructs the world and the kind of world of real objects that occasions this. So that's fine on the kind of big philosophical level of kind of realist and modernist epistemologies. But, okay, let's zoom down to the level of literary practice. If you kind of look at modernist works, you can find what are considered realist traces. If you look at realist works, you'll often find what you could describe as modernist traces. Let's take extreme subjectivity in third-person point of view, where, you know, people start narrating what's puttering through people's heads. Yeah? That's... And you'll get this in a standard kind of realist novel. Well, they're drawing on interior monologue, which is a classic modernist, apparently a classic modernist trope. If you look at, you know, high modernist works, you'll often find storylines in them, which apparently is, you know, you'll only find in modernism. So once again, to me it's a false binary, and it's for people who can't think for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But to me there's kind of a whole universe of literary tropes that you can figure how you please. The bottom line is you've got to create an object that's meaningful for a reader.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very insistent on that. I don't want to write work that isn't meaningful for a reader.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
It does answer.